Thank you, Padma Kumara, and good evening, everybody. This talk had its origins in a visit I made to Hungary with Vidyaruchi. Where is he? There he is. 3 weeks ago? Seems another lifetime, but not so long ago. You may have heard that we have in Hungary some mitras who are from a gypsy community. Just by the way, I gather that somebody was questioning the use of the term gypsy. They call themselves gypsy. They don't like the term Roma. These things are always particular to particular situations. So I'm using it advisedly. And they've come across the conversion movement in India led by Dr. Ambedkar, with which we're very strongly connected, as you probably know. And they've compared their own situation to that of the Dalits, the so-called ex-untouchables in India. They've seen themselves as, in a sense, the untouchables of Europe, at least one section of them. And I've been connected with them for about 5 years. I've been going out there twice a year and trying to communicate with them something of the perspective that Dr. Ambedkar has and something of the Dhamma. It's very, very interesting work they're doing. They're mainly working in North Hungary, which has been very badly hit by the change from the old system to the new free market. 90% of gypsies living in northern Hungary are unemployed. And circumstances amongst them are very bad indeed. Communism had full employment, and though it had for many people a great deal of restriction, most gypsies look back to it as a good period. The communists at least kept racial tension under control. Of course, it was institutionalised, but it was under control. Since the change took place, their economic situation has deteriorated horribly, and their social situation has deteriorated. The problem with democracy, it's a wonderful concept, except when you have minorities. Because what democracy does, unless there are constitutional safeguards, it means that the majority can tyrannise over the minority. And gypsies make up 6% of the population of Hungary. In neighbouring middle European countries, there are even larger proportions. I think it's 16% in Slovakia. And they're subject to a great deal of very active racism. So many of them don't go through the school system. They leave the school system quite early on. Still in quite a large part of Hungary, gypsy children are automatically declared mentally subnormal. So as soon as they go to school, they're put into classes for the subnormal. And many of them just drift out of education. There's no jobs, so what's the point of education anyway? And education is not really geared to them. There's no sort of traditions of learning and so forth in the families on the whole. There are some middle-class gypsies, but in the sort of areas where our friends are working, no. And so many gypsy girls and boys drop out. The girls tend to get pregnant very early, 13, 14, 15, and just don't go through any schooling. The boys often in jail by the time they're 15 or 16, in and out, and so on. I won't multiply the horrible story. It is pretty dreadful. Our friends, our mitras there, they have set up schools in northern Hungary for children, gypsy boys and girls, are not children, young adults, who've dropped out of the school system and who are being enticed back into learning. So they're very, very skillful indeed. It's very informal. It's very lively. A lot of music, a lot of dancing, and a lot of chaos. Anything can happen at any time. Vidyaruchi is very good at it. I've managed to work out how to deal with it. So you just can't quite work out when the things are going to start, when they're going to finish. But what they're doing is managing to engage people who've just not been through a school system and who couldn't sit in a classroom in the ordinary way, unless it had this sort of atmosphere of kind of openness and tolerance. And very impressive indeed what our friends are doing. They're mainly, the leaders of this movement are mainly themselves gypsies. This is the point. They've picked up Dr. Ambedkar's message, which is that don't wait for the higher castes to lift you up, lift yourself up. So they're saying we don't need Hungarians. I'm a Hungarian, by the way. Hungarian means white. We don't need them. We're going to do it ourselves. And if Hungarians want to help us, that's good. But we will be in charge. So it's a very strongly Ambedkarite message, for those of you who know anything about that, and a very impressive process. They've now got four schools in some major cities, some villages in a major city in northern Hungary, and their model is being imitated all over Hungary. And they locate themselves in a Buddhist context, an Ambedkarite Buddhist context. I'm not going to go into what the Ambedkarite dimension means. In a way, I've already said it. But they do consider themselves to be Buddhists, and slowly they're coming into the Dhamma and learning about the Dhamma and applying it within their own situation in a very particular sort of way. Again, the same sort of processes I've mentioned as regards education. And I feel a lot for that process. We've got some very good young friends there, and I hope that some of them will be coming over and staying in England, and it would be very good to set things up for them, to be able to come out of their small village. Many of them hardly been outside the village all their lives. They don't really even know, some of them, where Hungary is. They don't know how to locate it on the map. So very narrow perspective, extremely lively, a lot of music, as I say, and they love their own music, which is, yes, very lively and very, very stirring. In the last 3 or 4 years, there's been the rise of a political movement in Hungary that one can only describe as fascist. The situation in Hungary is quite peculiar. It was, of course, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and so participated in the First World War, and on the wrong side. In the Second World War, they joined the Axis, and again, were on the wrong side. So just before the Second World War, a fascist movement took over in Hungary, the Arrow Cross movement. And after the communists came, of course, it was a socialist country with all that involves, good and bad and ugly. But in a sense, they didn't go through quite the same sort of process of denazification that Germany so admirably has done. And as they've moved away from the communist era, away from the communist system into a free market democratic system, a whole lot of underlying racist and authoritarian attitudes have reemerged. To begin with, this was focused mainly on Jews, because I'm giving you too much information, but it's interesting background. Hungary wasn't fully cleared, as it were. There is still a large Jewish minority in Budapest, and they're very influential in economic and political life. So to begin with, the focus was on them, but there are not enough of them, and they're too powerful and to really be an adequate focus for a movement, as it were. So the gypsies have become the focus. And this new party, Jobbik, has come up very fast indeed. It has its own militia. It sends shivers down your spine when you know your European history. The Hungarian Guard. It's illegal, but it's been refounded on a new basis. So our friends are very, very worried indeed. very upset. Last year there were a series of murders of gypsies, which the police attributed to gypsies. So gypsies were arrested for the murder of some gypsies, and it was seen as a sort of internecine struggle. So these people were held for a year and more, and it's later emerged that they were murdered by skinheads, is the way it's talked about. It's a very unpleasant situation indeed. And it sort of got worse at the last European Union elections. Three MEPs were elected for quite a small country, Hungary, it's 10 million people, from Jobbik. And in the area where our people are working, 35% of people voted for this party. So our friends are very, very concerned indeed. And you think that in the village, for instance, where our work is taking place, half the village is gypsy. So 35% of people voted for Jobbik. That means pretty well most of the white people. When we arrived, we were driven up to northern Hungary from Budapest, and on the way our friends received a telephone call from the local chief of police. And the police chief said, Jobbik is going to come to Sojokaza, the village where we're working, and they are going to hold a political meeting. We are worried because in a nearby village, when this happened, there was a riot. Cars were burned by the gypsies. 100 gypsies were arrested. One had to notice no Hungarians. So we're worried about this. Can we meet with you? Our friends are the only sort of people who can be interlocutors in that situation. So our friends said, yes, we'll set up a meeting. And it took place while we were there, and we went. And I've experienced a lot of this sort of thing in India, not quite like this, but I'm very used to that sort of social strife and people being in an oppressive social position. But I've never seen anything quite like what we saw at that meeting. It was in the town hall, the village hall. There were about 200 gypsies, maybe 300 gypsies, all packed in there. All obviously very, very worried. And the police chief, the mayor and the deputy mayor sat out the front. My friend said later, it's just, 20 years ago, it's just from the communist era. This is the way things are set up. And the police chief got up and very matter-of-factly said, Jobbik is a, not that I could understand what he was saying, Jobbik is a political party, it's a legitimate a party, it has a right to meet, you have no right to disrupt its meeting, as long as you come, and if there's places for you, you can sit in the hall, but you cannot protest, you cannot disrupt. The mayor said, this is just a meeting for information, we don't want any discussion, we're just going to tell you what you can do, what you can't do, and we don't want a situation like in the neighbouring village. So, obviously, the people were very, very stirred up. What was really impressive was they were very measured. They were asking questions, but, with some passion and feeling, but quite reasonably. And this is because of the work that our friends are doing. They've given them a bit more of a voice, and they're able to express themselves in a more, reasoned way. They got nowhere. Most of the white Hungarians who I heard about speaking about it, I was told what they said, which was it's a legitimate political party, nothing to worry about. Although when you read their manifesto, there's plenty to be worried about, although it's very subtly expressed. So it's a very strong situation to be in. I've never been in anything quite like that. And, the absolute incomprehension between both sides, no communication. The situation had been set up in an entirely confrontational way. And I just don't know what's going to happen. It should be happening the next days, I think. I've been trying to contact and find out what happened. You know, I'm there, we're there, we're talking about Buddhism, we're trying to communicate the value of Buddhism for them and their lives, and you sort of realise that, well, this is what's really bothering them. It's the arrival of Yupik, it's the rise of fascism. If that's what's bothering them, I can't sort of talk about, you know, I don't know, what do we talk about? Concentrating your mind, being a bit happier, finding some meaning. You've got to talk about what the Dhamma has to say about their particular situation. And I mentioned that there were some suttas in the Pali Canon which deal with civil strife, in which the Buddha gives an analysis of civil strife. So Janosz and our other friends said, come on then, tell us. So I found myself having to boil down these suttas, which are, you know, put in a well, the translations, and I can refer a little bit to the Pali. They're put in a sort of rather stiff and technical language. I had to try to get at what they meant and communicate it to people whose educational level is very limited and who are in a very strongly angry and frightened state. So I did my best. I can't say that I was entirely successful, although I clearly did interest our mitras. They could see that this was useful to them. It's, I think, for them really to apply it. But in the course of doing it, well, I was struck by two things. First of all, the power of the analysis and the usefulness of knowing that is what's going on. I found I was looking at the whole situation differently myself as a consequence of boiling down and essentializing the Buddha's analysis. But I've also found that since I've been doing that, I've been noticing those processes in my own wretched mind. I've been noticing the same tendencies which the Buddha saw as underlying social violence. I've seen them sort of bubbling up in my own mind when I'm sitting to meditate. I had a letter just today, actually, in which I was criticised very, very strongly, and I must say, terribly unfairly. I was sitting there, and trying to sort of be with the mindfulness of breathing and all the rest of it. But all the time, my mind was just going, ooh, off. And the bastard, you know, it's because he's... And away I went. So I was remembering that I was just about to speak to this, and I'd better actually kind of apply it a bit. It's fairly sort of characteristic of what one will see in one's own meditation. One will see a process of taking off into distractions of all kinds. Sometimes those distractions are very pleasant, as you dream of, you know what to put in that place. Him, her, it, them, whatever. Sometimes they're very unpleasant. That's why. This is what. That's what I'm going to do. And so on. So it's both tells us what happens in what lies behind situations of violence and social strife, what lies behind war, what lies behind terrorism, what lies behind disputes in our ordinary social life, what lies behind our difficulties with girlfriends, boyfriends, husbands, wives, etc. So it does that, but in doing it, it shows us the processes that take place all the time within our own mind. So I'm going to be looking at this process in a somewhat essentialized form, with these two revelations in mind. What lies behind it is a series of suttas, a number of suttas from the Pali Canon, which is the main body of the Buddha's teachings, which I'm not going to refer to. I'm not going to try to refer to the technical terms. I'm not going to try to explain the etymology and philology and Buddhist philosophy and so forth. I'm just going to sort of take from what those suttas say, what I think they mean. Sagarmati is there, and he's going to tell you what it really means. Not tonight. He's going to be very nice to me afterwards and tell me that was absolutely correct. But on another occasion, to be arranged with Saraha, he's going to go through the sutta, the main sutta that I'm going to be basing this on, in much more detail, and you can look at the sort of origins of what I'm saying. And I hope that I'll be able to communicate the overall meaning of it, but Sagarmati can reveal more accurately and in more detail how it comes to say that. And no doubt he'll be able to find more in it than I'm able to communicate now, perhaps than I can see. So the Buddha is faced in a number of suttas with the question, why do people fall out? Why do they go to war? Why do they engage in rumour, slander, scandal, with an A, argument, dispute, violence, war, destruction? This is not a translation, but why do they get involved in this sort of conflict? I don't know whether you sometimes experience this. You find people are in acute dispute with each other, maybe even can't talk to each other. But, you know, they're both friends of yours, and they both seem very decent people, and you know, lots of goodwill, and yet they can't get on. And so, you know, even in that sort of sense, it's a puzzle. Why is it? What is it that happens that means that people end up even killing each other, and everything, you know, before that? That's what the Buddha was faced with. He was asked, to explain it. And this is the way he did it. So it's a Nidana chain. You're going to be doing a weekend on the Wheel of Life. There is going to be a weekend on the Wheel of Life in the next couple of weeks or something like that. And the Wheel of Life contains, amongst other things, this chain of conditioned arising. One thing arises, gives rise to another one. Gives rise to another one, another one, another one, another one. It unfolds. So, you know, the Buddha says that everything arises in dependence on conditions. There's nothing that's outside the process of change, that's outside the process of conditioned arising. So we can start at any point. We can examine anything, and especially any human phenomenon, and we can look at the conditions out of which it came, what it is that made it happen. You can see it in your own mind. You can see the chain of conditions that bring about any particular mental phenomenon. You know, for instance, you sit to meditate, and there's a particular state of mind there. Now, that state of mind didn't just sort of pop out of the sky. It didn't just happen at random. It arose because of a set of causes and conditions, some of which were very much to do with you. Obsessions, hopes, wishes, and so forth, which leave you with a particular mental state. And then that mental state gives rise to new mental states. So it's a whole big subject which Sagarmati's investigated very, very deeply, and I think he's going to be talking about here at the centre in the next weeks. Conditioned co-production. It's the main expression of the Buddha's understanding. Everything arises in dependence on conditions. So that means that if you want to understand anything, you need to look at the conditions out of which it came. And you can look at those conditions, trace them back to their origins, and in the case of mental phenomenon, if you want to stop them, you can stop them at their source. So the chain, the Nidana chain here, which is to do with violence, dispute, social disharmony, and so forth, has to be traced back to its roots in the individual human mind, and we need to deal with it there. We need to deal with it in the sense of dealing with it in ourselves, but we also need to find ways of dealing with it in the minds of people around us. I'll say much more about that in a while, because I think there's some quite interesting things to say, for instance, even about Jopik in Soyokasa, the best way to deal with the skinheads, the fascist skinheads coming to Soyokasa, this village in northern Hungary. So, as I say, I've essentialised what the Buddha says, and I'm not going to be referring to technical terms. I'll try to stop myself referring to technical terms. So the whole chain starts, well, we choose to start it, because, of course, no chain starts anywhere. The chains are infinite. They go back always. You can always trace them further. What you're always trying to do is tracing them back to the operative cause, if you like, what it is that in the situation has to be attended to change things. So the Buddha says that in this particular case, what we need to trace it back to is what I've called ordinary experience, or I've also called it primary experience. I'll explain why I've used that terminology in a moment. But you trace it back to just ordinary experience. Here you are, you've got your exploratory kit, your body, and you're getting sensory information, and sensory information is formed up into a picture and has a particular flavour to it, hedonic tinge to it, nice, nasty, wonderful, horrible, all that. And it's very basic. You're sitting here, you've got the feel of the ground underneath you, you've got a visual image of the room with somebody standing here talking, and you've got a basic categorization of what's going on, saying Subhuti is talking. So you've identified me, you've identified what I'm doing, you've identified the situation you're in a quite simple, basic way. And yes, you're either saying, God, this is boring, I have no idea what he's talking about, or fascinating. So you've got a sort of hedonic response, pleasurable or painful, broadly speaking. So I'm talking about very simple sense of immediate awareness of what's going on. Nothing complicated, no deep analyses, nothing philosophical, just a perfectly ordinary sense of being here, experiencing, ordinary things around you. And, of course, within that, yes, there's nice and nasty. There's pleasant and painful. And it's, of course, pleasure is pleasant and pain is painful. We don't like the pain and we like the pleasure. So what we want to do is we want to continue the pleasure, perfectly reasonable, and we want to escape from the pain, again, perfectly reasonable. But usually we don't make that very conscious. We're not really aware of what's going on. So there's a sort of a feeling of discomfort, a feeling of pain, of agitation or concern or unease. Say, to take the painful side of it. So, you want to get out of that. You want to make sure you don't have it again. The mind begins to work. What I've sort of puzzling it out. My very non-technical translation of a Pali word. But you're trying to work out what's going on. You're trying to orientate yourself in relation to the pleasurable or painful content of the situation. You're trying to find some sort of handle on it. And fundamentally, so that you can get out of the pain or keep the pleasure going or get some of it again, to put it very, very crudely. So yes, it's. I think that's the best way to think of it. You're trying to get some handle on what's going on. And it's a constant process all the time, experience is there, and we're sort of orientating ourselves in it. We're trying to get a handle on it. If it, the more painful it is, or the more pleasurable it is, the more intense our ratiocination, our attempt to get to grips with it and sort of puzzle it out, as I put it. Now, of course, a lot of that, it just let go. It just goes, because there's so much going on. Every moment of experience is accompanied by pleasure or pain. It's there all the time. And a lot of it is too mild or too subsidiary for us to bother about. So, you know, you might be sitting here and actually be a bit uncomfortable, but you're absolutely fascinated by the Buddha's teaching, said he, hopefully. So you don't sort of notice the pain, because you're getting some sort of, as it were, pleasurable experience from engagement with a Dhamma, for instance. But in some situations, the pleasure or pain becomes more significant to you and more important to you to escape or perpetuate. You know, one could have to say so much about that. There's a whole other set of investigations about pleasure and pain, which I think is extremely interesting. In a way, you could say the central concern of Buddhism is pleasure and pain. And there's a whole pleasure-pain calculus that is very, very interesting. But yes, you get either really quite stuck on keeping with the pleasure, or perpetuating the pleasure, or regaining the pleasure, or with escaping from the pain, or avoiding the pain. You get sort of into it. And at that point, somewhere along this process, it's difficult to say exactly where, because it's not even quite as linear as I've laid it out, sort of underlying tendencies come into play. You know, for instance, if you know, other people have sent you nasty letters and you've got angry before about them, then that starts to come into play at this point. So that the you can see a sort of momentum is gathering from the initial experience through the puzzling of that initial experience out in order to try to, well, sort of vaguely to begin with, try and work out how to keep the pleasure going and avoid the pain. It fits in with underlying patterns which go very, very deep, very deep indeed, and all the way up, right down to the sort of roots of greed and hatred in our minds, and right, you know, to patterns laid down in childhood and patterns laid down yesterday. They all sort of begin to come into play. And the whole thing begins to go mad, to put it that way. It begins to spread out. The word that I'm translating here is obsessive thinking, which is not really quite right, means spreading out, complicating, complexifying. You begin to draw into what initially was just to do with an experience, you draw into it a whole mass of other experiences, memories. You draw in theory. You draw in what, you know, theories about life that you learnt in childhood. People with glasses can't be trusted, or, you know, things like that. These all sort of begin to bear on you know, this stream that's come up from the initial experience. And yeah, you really go to town on it. You're sitting there all the time. It's going on in your mind. You're making connections. Ah, this fits with that. This is part of that pattern. This fits into an overall theory that I learned, a religious theory, a philosophical theory, just a vague sort of prejudice about life. And it all fits together. New feelings come stirred up. And it gradually forms a sort of mass. And that mass is what I call a constructed system of interpretation. So you've gradually worked up this whole complicated stream of mental processes into a picture, an interpretive picture, which is not necessarily self-consistent, because it's not a philosophical theory necessarily, although philosophical theories are often one form of this kind of constructed system. Political theories are usually of this kind of construction. Well, almost inevitably they are. So it gets sort of formed. Not necessarily formulated, but it gets formed. And it begins to be the way you walk through the world. And it begins to then influence the way in which primary experience is interpreted. So your basic experience is now filtered through a whole constructed complex, a vast complex which reaches deep into your own past, your own experience, other people's experience, the experiences of your race, your class, your tribe, whatever, your family. It all gets sort of bound up together and starts to be the interpretive framework through which you filter just feelings, sensations, and the basic interpretation of things as, you know, person out there, walls, ceiling. It all starts to be filtered through this interpretive complex. Then what happens? What happens is your interpretive complex comes into collision with somebody else's interpretive complex. And they see things very differently. They've constructed the world in a very different way. Their basic experiences, their pleasures and pains have worked up over their lifetimes into a quite different pattern and picture. And they collide. They collide. At best, it just leads to a temporary misunderstanding, and at worst, it leads to war, murder, terrible oppressions, and so on. So these interpretive structures are very real. We've all got them in a sort of local, personal sense, but they become shared. And we reinforce each other in these interpretive structures. What I'm most familiar with is in India, the interpretive structure of caste. So people see things in terms of caste. They see that, you know, I belong to this community, those people belong to that community or that community, and all your attitudes to that person immediately are filtered through that framework. So as soon as you meet somebody, you need to work out what their caste is. Once you've worked out what their caste is, all your relationship with them, your responses to them, are determined. It's very, very striking indeed. But that's just a very explicit form of what we're all doing in one way or another in a social context. We've all got our class structures, race structures, etc., etc., which are overlaid on top of our very basic primary experience. So we come to live in what I call secondary reality, in which we've become removed from basic experience. Basic experience is now filtered through this interpretive framework. So we're not actually seeing what's really going on, you could say. And that then leads us to clash with other people's secondary realities. I found this very interesting. I sort of thought of the term secondary reality, and then I sort of remembered that there's something called second life. Apparently you can have a second life on the internet. A friend of ours had a second life girlfriend who then dumped him, and he was second life upset and jealous. But it is quite interesting. In a way, I think that one of the influences of modern technology and the way it constructs and interprets reality for us is very much in this line of constructions of systems of interpretation. It reinforces, it adds to our removal from basic experience. And in fact, quite often we go to quite a lot of lengths to escape from basic experience. I've noticed the extent to which people use mobile phones when they're walking. You even see it in the park down there in Cannon Hill Park. People out for a walk in what passes for nature in Birmingham. Sorry, I don't live in Birmingham, so I make little digs every now and again. Actually, it's a lovely park. I used to really love it when I lived here, but I live in Wales now, so where the primary reality is wet. So people are wandering around, in space, in nature and so forth, but on a mobile phone. So you're not really with what's, basic and straightforward. You're in this sort of electronically mediated communication in which you've got an image of the other person. And of course you can communicate on the phone, really communicate on the phone, but I think probably relatively rarely, to be frank, to give my own interpretive framework. So I think there's quite an interesting sort of side reflection, which I won't go further into now, the way in which the way our technology works for us, I think tends to accentuate our removal from primary reality, which is already habitual, going way back in our lives. So let's just follow through one strand of how this interpretive framework works in building up to political and social tension and even violence. Jobbik in Hungary, this right-wing, extreme right-wing fascist party. Basic experience. There you are, you're a Hungarian peasant, particularly a young Hungarian peasant or a young Hungarian worker. And you lose your job. And because the free market economy has, of course, meant much more efficiency, which means people out of work. And you're having to rely on your bit of family land, which is very small and doesn't really give you much. Straight away, you thought you were coming out of the communist era, that you thought you were going to be, as my friends say, in Switzerland or Austria within 3 or 4 years. You thought Hungary was going to be transformed into rich first world. It's not third world by any means, but it's quite a bit poorer than Britain, for instance. And it's not happened. What you thought was going to come has not come. And you feel, quite worried, insecure. You also feel you've been cheated somehow. Of course, you're beginning to get to work on it now. You feel that, you were promised more than this. You were promised something else. And then you begin to think, come to think of it, this is what's happened to Hungary for 400 years. Hungary was last a truly independent country in 1490. And since then it's been conquered by Turks, by Germans, by Russians, and everybody else as well. More recent history, Hungary in 1919 at the Peace of Versailles lost 2/3 of its territory and 1/3 of its linguistic population. So you've got this sort of, into it all starts to come your sense of injustice. And at the same time, you're a Hungarian. That's quite something, because the Hungarians share no linguistic affinities with any other neighbour. It's a completely different language family. It's not Indo-European. Its nearest linguistic affinities with Finnish, and they have about 100 words in common. And I think the next nearest is a Siberian tribe right up on over near the Sea of the Bering Strait. You've got this sense that you're something unique, you're something special, and there's a whole sort of mythology of the arrival of the Magyars and their conquest of the barbarian Slavs and the Germans and so on and so forth, and their creation of their own distinctive Magyar culture. So all of this starting to come in on this poor guy who's just lost his job and who's basically in severe economic difficulties, is beginning to worry desperately about his own future. All of that sort of nationalistic and racial sort of these ideas, these obsessive thinking is pulling together, and he's got a lot of help from people who basically their interest is in power, because power brings, well, all sorts of benefits. And it all gets constructed in a political ideology, and that political ideology has to have a target. The Jews are not a convenient target. There are not enough of them, and they're too subtly powerful in the background. And also, Europe really doesn't like talk, and Germans particularly don't like talk about Jews. Gypsies, however, when you look at the crime statistics, they're way, way out of proportion. Most of the jails are full of gypsies, many more gypsies than anybody else. You know, the welfare system is mainly supporting gypsies. So there you are. There's the problem. That's our problem. It's gypsy criminality. And that gypsy criminality in the background, this is not openly stated, is genetic. They can't help it. It's so 1930s, it's difficult to sort of believe. But this is the construction of reality, which explains everything. It explains why you're so humiliated, why you're so insecure. What you really need is a strong leadership, which will sort out the problem, will get the army, get a military police out in the countryside. They'll stop the gypsies soon enough. There you are. It's all sorted out. We've got the theory that makes us feel strong. We can march in the Magyar Guard with our neckties and berets and so on, batons, and do military drill. And we begin to feel some of the pride and some of the hope that we lost way back there. There's a whole lot more one could say, but that gives at least one sort of, I hope, illustration of how this works up. And this is a fairly extreme example. We've got the same things going on here in the right-wing fascist sense, and in left-wing and in all sorts of middle wings as well. And, of course, then it starts to, you know, for instance, every time you see a gypsy, you know, you tighten. And the gypsies, you know, they've got the classic response to a situation in which they're, you know, feared, which is doing a bit of F you. You know, showing that they're defiant, they're cheeky, they're a bit dangerous, as it were. Is going to a supermarket with a bunch of them is terrifying and fun. But, you know, if you're a Jopik member, there's your confirmation. Look at them. Look at the way they're behaving. Look at the attitude they have. So you get this sort of horrible cyclical system where the two sets of constructions coincide. It was fascinating. When I gave this account, one of the young gypsies there started saying, "Pooh, you know, I don't want to understand them. There's really only one solution, just kill them." You know, our friends persuaded him that might not actually be the solution. But, you know, again, it's his sort of secondary reality coinciding with another secondary reality. So, there it is. And, yes, you can see it in these large-scale social conflicts, these patterns of misunderstanding within your own home and your own society, at work and so forth. You can see the same patterns going on. It's very, very useful to understand this and to be able to see what's going on. So if we can understand, for instance, that the Jopik member who's actually your neighbour is frightened of you, insecure about his own job and so forth, you may be able to respond to him. If you're responding to him up here, well, you may win. You'll very likely lose if you're just 6% of the population. So if you can understand, you may be able to affect, you may be able to cut the circle short, as it were. You may be able to cross the boundary. So, for instance, I discovered that in India, there's a very great deal of tension, as you probably know, between Muslims and Hindus. Muslims are the smaller, they're about 20% of the population, so they're almost always ultimately the victims. They do their share of mayhem, but they always, just through sheer numbers, lose, and the system is heavily stacked against them. But I read the very big riots in Gujarat, what, 4 years ago, something like that, when a lot of Muslims were killed. It looks as if the state government was complicit in that, maybe even organised it. But what some researchers found was that where there were civic organisations which consisted of both Muslims and Hindus, no killings took place, no rioting took place. So before you get to this point, if you can get a puzzling out that's shared, you may be able to prevent the cycle from starting. So there's so much more one could say about that, but that's perhaps as much as I'm going to say about the bearing that this model has. This, well, it's not a model, it's an analysis of what happens on how you might prevent that strife from arising in the mind of another person or another group or whatever. You need to understand what has happened from the point of... Well, you need to understand what the painful experience is, or pleasant experience, or pleasant expectation is, that starts the cycle. And then you can begin to respond in a helpful way. But I now want to shift gear and come back much more down to us and our own immediate experience, and try to apply a more, a meditative analysis of how one needs to respond. The first thing is that you need to come back to primary experience. You need to come back to what's actually happening. In other words, you need to be mindful, especially. You need to be mindful of your body. This is the Buddha's teaching in this regard. Come back to feeling your feet on the ground, feeling your weight on the ground, feeling the flow of energy in your body, and so on, feeling your contact with things. Just very simple, basic experience. And if you find yourself going off on this cycle, that's the first thing to do. Just come back straightforwardly to what's really going on. Because once you start off on this cycle, you've lost touch with what's going on. You're off in a mentally constructed, increasingly constructed universe. So you try to come back to the one thing you can rely on. You can rely on the fact that when your finger touches that object, there's a sensation. That sensation is undeniable, it's uncomplicated, it's there. You know that you're experiencing it. So you come back to what is undeniably valid, basic experience, which is in the first place, contact, sensation. In the second place, it's... the hedonic tone of things. How do you feel? Are you comfortable, for instance, in your body? Is there pain anywhere in your body? Come back to those absolutely basic hedonic correlatives of sensation, the pleasure or pain that's connected with any sensation. Maybe very nothing, just a neutral feeling. You come back to that. Come back to the mental hedonic tone. Are you happy? Are you sad? Are you feeling cheerful? Are you feeling despairing or whatever? What are you actually feeling in that sense? And come back to the things that you know. Table, chair, carpet, floor, ceiling. No, looking up at the floor, ceiling, floor. Come back to what, just straightforwardly, what we all agree on. Light fitting, you know what I mean? Just come back to what you actually can label and identify without much complication. Of course, we can always argue about whether something, where the floor begins and the ceiling ends. But in a broad, common sense way, come back to that. Come back to primary reality. And I think quite often you can do this in a sort of systematic way, at will. You just find you've got carried away. You're off. You're, you know, obsessing about that letter. And so just come back to being here, to experiencing yourself in this situation with the things around you in a quite ordinary sense. So that's where it really starts going. It starts. What's really going on in a straightforward, primary sense? Not looking for the conspiracy that lies behind it all. Not trying to get fancy about whether it's real or not. Just what is ordinarily present. Even if you're in a dream, you can do this. What, you know, because in a dream you've got sensations and feelings and so forth. So what are those sensations? What are those feelings? Just come back to that. Even if you're... Anyway, we won't go on. So yeah, come back to sort of fact, if you like, of the situation itself. And this, yes, is what we call mindfulness. You can use it a systematic way to escape this runaway cycle, just coming back to what you know, and especially coming back to the body is probably the most inescapable element in our experience. It's much more difficult sometimes to catch the flow of feelings, and of course thoughts are much more difficult, interpretations much more difficult, but it's very easy to stick with, or much more easy to stick with veridical bodily experience. That's what we're doing in the mindfulness of breathing, as it is, for instance. You're not trying to think about the breathing. You're trying to actually experience the tickling sensations and the warmth and the colds and so forth. I think it's quite important to not just feel a sensation, but feel the pleasurable, even painful elements of it, so that you're trying to just accept what's really basically going on. And we, in Buddhism, should be training ourselves to be as much based in this fundamental primary experience as we can, so that we keep on coming back to it, staying with it. While you're sitting here, you're listening to me, but you know where you are, you know where your body is, you can feel the contact. Of course, you can't give your full attention to that, because you're trying to listen. But you try to stay present, you might say. So we try to train ourselves in that way. And it's very, very good, I think, to spend time every day with a little extra effort at being with primary experience, which means, for instance, just going for a walk in the park, turning your mobile phone off, and experiencing your feet touching the ground, experiencing the cool of the breeze, the wet of the wind, the rain, the green of the trees and so forth. But just staying with, probably better staying with basic bodily experience, so that you root yourself, you ground yourself much, much more firmly in primary experience. So that's the first thing. Oh my goodness me. Time. I'm going to have to race. So the second thing is, of course, overcoming this tendency to get out of control. And that's primarily what we're working with meditation. For many of us, that's our main thing, is stopping this process from going on. I find that a lot, that I'm not, sometimes just sitting, for instance. You're just sort of seeing that stream of obsession arise, stopping it. Or not stopping it, just letting go of it. Not letting it solidify. You're sort of saying, look, I'm trying to create a solid reality. Let it go. Let it go. And you're just constantly letting it go and learning, if possible, to experience the calm, still, thought-free states of dhyana, if you can, or the very positive intentions of Maitri. But at the very least, constantly unhooking from this process as it constantly jerks into action. It's all the time sort of getting going. You let it go. Gets going. Let it go. So that's what we're doing in meditation. But we also need to apply some reflection, because the process itself begins with thinking. It begins with reflection. So we need to be thinking about what's going on in terms of, what's real. I'm going to have to cut short now, but one would think about it in terms of the lakshanas, if you know this, if you know these, that the fact that it's not permanent, that's quite important. Notice that the feelings themselves come and go. Notice that they're not real, they have no permanent existence. They come, they go. Pain comes, pain goes. Pleasure comes, pleasure goes. So you're constantly unhooking, you're letting go, you're recognising what's happening. But you're also, you need to apply thought as to what to do. Something's happened. What are you going to do? Somebody's written you a nasty letter. What are you going to do? Yes, you try not to get caught up in the move towards a secondary reality. What you do, you apply the precepts. The precepts are a guide to skillful action. They're a guide to how you deal with the situations that arise in your experience in a way that is constructive for you and for others, and in a way that will, in the longer term, bring you greater and greater pleasure and satisfaction. So you step back from this whole process. Experience has happened. Action is asked of you. Don't get caught up in a cycle that leads simply to reaction and conflict. Apply the precepts. Try to see how, in this situation, you can act in the way that is best for you and best for everybody. How can you, when Yopik comes to town, act in such a way that you are safe, that your friends and your family are safe, and that ultimately those people from Yopik who feel insecure and humiliated feel some normal human pride and confidence? How can you achieve that situation? So the precepts we bring in here in order to check ourselves from going on a set of actions that are driven by this obsessive process and its secondary reality. So, golly, that went very, very quickly for me. I don't know about you. But there's quite a bit more to say there, and maybe more will come out in Sagarmati's look at it. But I hope you've got some idea of the Buddha's analysis of social conflict, and some idea of what your own wretched mind is doing quite a lot of the time, and what you need to do about it. What you need to do about it is come back to basic reality. Be mindful of what's going on, especially in your body, but in your feelings and more if you can. You need to apply a dhammic analysis to what's going on. You need to see that it's impermanent, it has no ultimate reality, and that it's not going to be a source of permanent satisfaction. And you need to bring the precepts in so that you can act in a way that is skillful for you, that is harmless for you and harmless for others. I often think that skillful would be better translated as helpful. So you want action that is helpful to you, helpful to others. This is the burden of this particular analysis. So I hope that we can reflect much more on this and apply it in our own experience, and perhaps apply it to the social situations around us, both in the microcosmic sense of our own family and social context, but in the macrocosmic sense of, our national life and even our international life. Thank you.